Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to open the batting for tonight's debate. So our world seems to be reacting to the inequalities brought about by globalization, by a retreat into nationalism and protectionism. This is not new. According to a recent article in the New York Times by Ruchir Sharma, the chief global strategist for Morgan Stanley, the outbreak of World War I ended 4 decades of rising migration and trade, with huge flows of goods, money, and people across borders, in which millions benefited. As today, it was the elite that gained the most, and it stirred fierce resentment among those left behind. After the economy crashed in 1929, the US Congress passed a sweeping tariff act. Trade, which was 30% of the world's economy at its peak, slowed to less than 10% in 1933. Immigration in the US declined from more than 1 million annually to a few tens of thousands. Similar reactions took place in other countries. However, these reactions prolonged the depression and economic stagnation and led to the rise of nationalism and totalitarian regimes. Global trade did not fully recover until the 1970s, and capital mobility did not recover until the 1990s. Today, especially since the financial crisis of 2008, globalization is on the retreat again, with increased calls of restrictions to mobility and trade and a rise in nationalism. There's considerable debate about the way forward for the UK after Brexit. A chief reason for Brexit was the feeling of many that they did not share in the economic prosperity of globalization and of membership in the EU. Rather, they faced stagnating wages and increased pressure on resources, infrastructure, and costs. Virtually all economists on both the left and the right agree that retreating into protectionism would simply repeat the mistakes of the past and cause all of us to be worse off. Fortunately, the UK continues to believe in free trade. However, if we have to have free trade and restrict mobility, and at the same time we want to ensure people a decent minimum wage and standard of living, we will not be able to compete purely on the basis of traditional industry. So in doing so, we have no choice except to spur increases in productivity, which will require innovation. So the heart of any new industrial strategy has to be to spur innovation, which in turn will require science and technology. Fortunately for us, the UK is one of the leaders in research and innovation by almost every measure. The older industries, both in the UK and US, were based on proximity to raw materials and what at the time was world-leading technology. Many of these industries are not particularly competitive today. It is doubtful that steel mills and coal will return on a large scale either to Pennsylvania or to the north of England. Even if they were to do so, automation and other efficiencies will ensure that they will not create the large numbers of well-paying jobs that they did in the past. In the US, much of the innovation and the resulting economic growth has occurred in the Northeast Washington to Boston corridor or on the West Coast. This has left the vast hinterland of the US behind, so the result of the US election is not surprising in hindsight. In the UK, similarly, much of the new economy is concentrated in areas like London and Cambridge. Newer knowledge-based industry relies on easy and rapid acquisition of information to have a competitive advantage. In a laissez-faire environment, the growth of these clusters will continue at the expense of other areas, and it's a natural consequence of economics. A key aspect of this is the so-called agglomeration effect. Small and large companies want to be in an environment where there's complementary expertise and industry all around them. There's a reason that AstraZeneca moved its research headquarters from the north of England. The three places on their shortlist were the Bay Area, Boston in the US, and Cambridge. Fortunately for the UK, they chose Cambridge. The move to Cambridge would not have made sense on the basis of cost alone. Housing costs for their employees, as well as running costs, infrastructure costs, are all much higher in Cambridge. However, the life sciences cluster in Cambridge meant they would be plugged into first-rate research and innovation, be able to recruit skilled employees, and benefit from the so-called first mover's advantage. Given the geographical inequalities it generates, a laissez-faire approach is not sustainable politically. So how then should a strategy ensure that different parts of the country are not left behind? I believe it would be a mistake to try to artificially prop up designated parts of the country with targeted investments that may simply favor existing industries that are in decline. Sometimes it's possible for cities to reverse decline by investing in completely new areas. For example, Pittsburgh, previously in decline because of the steel industry, is now rejuvenating itself thanks to investment in new technologies, facilitated by having two top universities, including Carnegie Mellon, a world leader in computer science and robotics. It's currently working with Uber to test driverless cars on its streets. In general, though, it's not possible to predict how to reverse decline by shift to new areas. Rather than trying to predict winners, the government should put most of its resources to improving opportunities for growth. A major part of this involves reducing the isolation and improving the connectivity of the entire country. High-speed connectivity, both virtual through high-speed internet or higher-speed internet, and real connectivity through high-speed transport will ensure that places that are currently left behind will quickly connect up with the highest growths of economic growth areas nearby. For example, the UK has large centres that could either are or could be the nucleus for future growth. The Manchester, Sheffield, Leeds area could be a hub, which, if appropriately connected with surrounding areas and also among themselves, could lift up not only themselves, but areas such as Grimsby and Hull, which are currently isolated from these centres. Similarly, large parts of East Anglia could be connected up to Norwich and further to Cambridge and create a much larger network of connected areas. High-speed links will ensure that their residents will be able to work where the jobs are being created. But more importantly, it'll reduce barriers to local industries to develop, since they will feel less isolated. In addition to connectivity, one really important requirement is the creation of large local pools of skilled workers. Creating this will require large and sustained investment in education. All governments that I know of have paid lip service to education, but education for the future will need to be flexible and broad-based to prepare people for the rapidly changing and often disruptive economies of the future. These measures will take time, and if we're to prosper enough to be able to implement them over a long period, there are some pressing measures to ensure that the UK remains at the forefront of science and technology and sustained growth in the immediate term. And these measures involve mobility, funding, and regulations. The first of these is mobility. A major reason for the success of UK science and technology is that it's been an open and welcoming society to the best talent from all over the world. 5 of the last 15 Nobel laureates based in the UK were foreign-born. In fact, 3 of the last 5 presidents of the Royal Society were foreign-born, and a 6th was the son of immigrants. Science today is global and depends on a free flow of people who bring in new ideas and expertise. Our own young scientists also benefit enormously from going abroad for training. So migration is not a one-way street. It works both ways. Today, 30% of our academic research staff and a similar proportion of both CEOs and skilled workers in companies are from abroad. We're second only to the US as a destination for global talent. The presence of these international workers ensures that we remain first-rate, and just as importantly, produces a first-rate environment for training homegrown talent. Losing them would be a disaster both for our science and for our economy. We need to take immediate steps to reassure those who are here that they remain welcome. I learned recently that an EU citizen working here has to fill out a 90-page form with lots of onerous and unnecessary reporting simply to gain the right to remain indefinitely. In the future, rather than making EU citizens go through the same long and cumbersome procedures that everyone else has to do to gain the right to work here, we need to streamline procedures for everyone so that they're fair, transparent, and efficient. Reducing the barriers to mobility will enhance our competitiveness and send a strong message that the UK will always welcome talent from around the world. It's worth remembering that immigration was only the second most important reason why people voted for Brexit. And even so, it was control over migration that people wanted, not the complete absence of immigration. A majority of the British, including leading Brexiteers, are not against the movement of skilled labour into the country. So the recent rhetoric around migration has been both unhelpful and unnecessary, and the government needs to send a strong message to counter it. Finally, counting students as part of migration figures is both unreasonable and a poor strategy. Only a small fraction of them stay on beyond their studies, and mostly to our benefit. And if they stay on, they can be counted towards migration figures at that time. The rest return to their home countries and are forever valuable links to the UK. They become future leaders and are more likely to look at the UK as natural partners for trade and investment. We're in danger of turning away entire generations of future partners who would be well disposed towards us by putting up unnecessary barriers to students and restricting opportunities for them. The second point was funding. The UK will not be perceived as an attractive global destination for talent and investment if we reduce our investment in research. We're already at the low end of the OECD countries in investment as a fraction of our GDP. Given that, we're nevertheless so productive that increased investment in research would actually be an excellent return. From 2005 to 2010, investment in science was maintained in flat cash terms due to austerity. So in real terms, there was a decline due to inflation. We were nevertheless able to be competitive because during that time, we increased our support from the EU. Loss of these funds would be a serious problem for our research enterprise. With our departure from the EU, it's essential that our funding be at least maintained. Science is a small fraction of our overall expenditure. And moreover, private investment in research very closely tracks public spending. In fact, that's true in all countries. So there's a multiplier effect. In considering how to restore funds, it's worth pointing out that our funding from the EU was valuable not just for monetary reasons. It was the basis of collaborations and partnerships that greatly expanded the influence of UK-based researchers. It allowed us to have a say in the future of large facilities and general scientific agenda directions. So a more appropriate way would be for the UK to use its contributions to buy its way into multinational programs in the EU. One obvious way would be to continue to contribute to such programs as Horizon 2020, which include the ERC. But if that were not politically possible, another way would be to create an equivalent pot which would allow us to collaborate not only with Europe but beyond Europe internationally and perhaps also have our own ERC equivalent. And this pot could be, for instance, administered through the new UCRI body that's being envisioned. Over the long run, if we want to remain competitive, we need to move towards the OECD average in investment. Although we're efficient, we cannot hope to permanently maintain our advantage while underinvesting in science. The final part I want to briefly touch on is regulations. The UK has benefited from a common regulatory policy within the EU, which is useful for collaborations across the continent, for example, involving animal research, genetics on humans, etc. However, the UK on its own has excelled in enlightened regulatory policy for new technologies that takes into account a proper balance of both risks and benefits. For example, long before it was acceptable in most places, the UK pioneered IVF babies. Recently, we have the example of the UK leading the way in the so-called three-parent babies to eliminate mitochondrial defects. We're also much more rational about stem cells, which resulted in leading scientists coming to work here from the US. And currently, we're much more forward-looking about areas like genome editing. So the UK potentially has great advantages in new areas where regulations, ethics, liability, and technology intersect. Some examples are the use of large sets of personal data to drive discovery and innovation, for example, in health, where we can benefit from the fact that we have single-payer health through the NHS, which has a huge database of millions of patients. The UK's experience regulations could also help us with technologies such as driverless vehicles and robotics, which also have many of these areas intersect. And finally, our experience in setting standards will help us to define new technologies and give us a competitive advantage. So in summary, although most of us in the scientific community were for remaining in the EU, we recognize the social conditions that resulted in the referendum vote. It should be possible for us to flourish outside the EU and at the same time ensure that benefits are spread throughout different parts and sections of the country. But to do so will require that we make the right decisions as we go forward. Thank you.